Meet Reed Lance Rosenthal, rancher, number one best-selling award-winning author, and unabashedly, unapologetically, on the right side of the outstanding issues of our generation. But don't try to fence him in. Sometimes his positions will surprise you, because Reed is definitely his own man, with his own opinions. You might love him, you might hate him, but you won't be able to stop listening. Step over to the right side with Reed.
Happy Saturday, folks. It's Reed Lance Rosenthal on the Right Side Radio. And it's another big show because all sorts of stuff is going on and who knows if we're going to have time to cover it all. But we're going to finish up. This is now the fourth part of our historical story, The Collapse of Civilizations. Quite interesting. This has to do with population and fertility and signs over the times and the philosophers and archaeologists and historians that have kind of tracked this and how it coincides with something we're going to talk about in depth next week, the Kondratieff wave, waves of 50 years of economic cycles, which also translates back to population, which also translates back to whether civilizations stand or fall. We're going to do our rat-a-tat-tat, a little bit expanded this week since we abbreviated it last week, and there's been all sorts of stuff going on. You can't even cover it. I mean, I could do 10 shows in a row on rat-a-tat-tat every week. I'm going to bring you up to speed on COVID, some very interesting things on the vaccine front and on the illness front and on the death front and on this Delta variant, you know, how convenient. And Fauci, tricky Tony, fraudulent Fauci. And then we are going to talk about, finally, I've been trying to do this for like 5 weeks, Albert Camus, C-A-M-U-S, and the problem with rebellion, the difference between rebellion and revolution. And finally, if we have time, we're going to finish up with China's assault on the dollar, digital currencies, what the United States has planned, which is not great for all United States citizens, you know, the Fed coin nonsense, and some ominous signs from China and Russia on potential military expansion. Not just threats, but war games, and a warning by the Japanese of an impending attack on America by joint Sino-Soviet forces. Very interesting. Very interesting. So let's get started, shall we? The historical story. Let's just do a quick recap. So a civilization, because we have covered the gamut here, a civilization is a complex human society. It has different cities. It is urban-based. Certain characteristics of cultural and technological development are always in play. And the word civilization is a Latin word, civitas, or city. Civilizations have urban settlements. They're not nomadic. Labor is divided into specific jobs, which is called the division of labor. I've covered this over the past several weeks with you. This allows everyone to not focus on growing their own food. It allows them to do other things, which expand culture and expand technology and expand business and expand trade and opportunity. Then there comes a class structure in civilization and a government, both of them critical aspects of quote-unquote civilization or society. Another criteria for civilization is a surplus of food because you have tools to aid in growing crops and you have that division of labor. And you have trading and artwork and monuments and development of science and technology. So that is what civilization is. Now, civilizations over history have fallen for a number of reasons. And that number of reasons, which we have reviewed in the last three shows, and we're going to finish up in this show, it's when it gets, and I'm just going over the big ones, okay? Because there's lots of little things that all contribute to the undermining of the foundation of a civilization, the toppling of that civilizational, that societal house, you know, over on its side. Basically, complexity. As civilizations become more complex, they become slower to react. They become less united, more disintegrated amongst their various factions. When trade is interrupted, civilizations can fall. climate change, and I don't mean climate change like, you know, the morons in Washington talk about it. I'm talking about cataclysmic events, huge droughts, volcanoes. All these things can affect the ability to grow food, can affect another aspect of civilizational collapse, which is mass migration and the watering down of the original population of a civilization with populations that, shall we say, don't care as much about the founding principles that created the great society that they are entering. So these are all kind of key points in civilizational collapse. Yes, disease, pandemics can topple civilizations because it affects all the other aspects of that society. There's only three outcomes to the collapse of a civilization. I mean, there's only three end games, if you will. And that is, some revive and are transformed. Some never recover. Some just disappear. Some are conquered. And some are absorbed by surrounding civilizations. There is no other alternative. In other words, you live or you die or you change. So here we are in a civilizational time in the Western world where we're kind of meeting all the criteria, right? I'm going to tie this all in for you over the last 4 weeks. We have increasing fragility. We have, of course, this the conjured COVID, which goes on and on and on. And then following that will be the, you know, we're all going to incinerate. We're all going to die in 9 years from climate change. Whatever the fear mongers want to whip up to try and control the population. We have, obviously, increasing complexity, like complexities upon complexities. And we're beginning to see scarcities in certain basic materials, like rare earth materials, rare earth minerals, which are key to technological advances, which we have allowed China to kind of control around the world. And I'm just using that as one. And then some of this we've done to ourselves. The third term Obama administration is busy making oil and fossil fuels scarce when just a year ago they were abundant. Obviously, the increases in prices, the abilities to conduct business, conduct trade, make technological advances are all undermined by these policies. Not that they care. In fact, I think they cheer it. Okay, they cheer it because America has to be just another seat at the table of nations. All the great philosophers, all the great archaeologists, all the historians agree. And we've gone over what their theories are, particularly last week. If you missed that show, onthe rightsideradio.com. That's onthe rightsideradio.com. It'll be right over on the left-hand side of the first page. And you should listen to it. It's some great thinkers over thousands of years. But social declines, they all agree to this. Social declines are inevitable with rising levels of complexity. And social declines inevitably lead to collapse and disintegration of what had previously been a common culture and society into simpler, in a way, but more separate societies. You know, there's going to be an interesting story in the Rat-a-tat-tat about this athlete who basically turned her back on the national anthem as she was getting her bronze medal. And something she says kind of goes right into this historical story. We'll talk about that here when we get to that segment. But let's shift our focus to this last slab, if you will, in this tile floor of civilizational collapse. The Greek historian Polybius, this is, you know, thousands of years ago, he blamed the decline of the Hellenistic world, you know, the fall of Troy, etc., we've talked about it over the last three shows, on low fertility rates. What he said was that there were protracted wars and there were deadly epidemics, but when those ingredients to turmoil were removed, people were generally more interested in, you know, show and money and pleasure and leading an idle life rather than marrying and raising children. And those who did have children had no more than one or two, with the express intention, by the way, of leaving them better off than the parents and indulging them in extravagant luxuries. Does this sound familiar right now in the Western world? Yes, it certainly does. Rome, both Greece and Rome, suffered and their civilizations collapsed in part due to these ups and downs and incongruencies in population. In Rome, it got so bad. And by the way, Roman women were known for divorcing, having extramarital affairs, being reluctant to bear children. All this evolved as Rome became more and more prosperous in its heyday. It got so bad that Caesar Augustus actually brought up legislation and got it installed and operating, shall we say, designed to increase the birth rate. Men aged 20 to 60 and women aged 20 to 50 were legally obligated to marry. Widowed or divorced individuals within those relevant age ranges were required to remarry. There were exemptions granted to those who had already had three children, and four children if you were a freed slave. For the political or bureaucratic classes, preference was given to advancement and to getting positions within the government to those with at least three legitimate children. If you didn't follow the rules, there were diminished inheritance rights and a bunch of other taxation and shall we say, negative forces invoked to make you marry and to make you procreate. There was a Roman poet by the name of Ovid, and he believed, as did Augustus, I might add, that the low birth rates of the original Romans and the Roman elite were exacerbated by freed slaves that had been given Roman citizenship, reproducing at faster rates than the original population, so that the, quote, original stock, unquote, as they called it, was not replacing themselves and leaving the task to foreigners, the task being running the country, making decisions, upholding values, culture, all those types of things. Once again, in the rat-a-tat-tat, there is a perfect example of what I'm talking about back 2,500, 3,000 years ago and today. By the way, all these prenatal or these pronatal policies and rules were totally unsuccessful. Roman elites, you know, the original Roman, the original stock, they had access to contraception even back then. This knowledge was lost, this is a side note, to Europe during the Middle Ages and the early modern period, but that's a tale for another day. But Romans could enjoy sexual intercourse without ever having to rear additional children. And people of higher socioeconomic class of the Greco-Roman world were able to control their fertility. Not only that, that ability likely trickled down to the lower classes in both the Greek and the Roman societies, and the results are predictable, right? You're going to have less folks, and you're going to have less of a certain kind or type or caste of folks. What happened is as this fertility rate continued to fall, and people came to the conclusion that it was up to them, rather than the gods, how many children they had, there were other population imbalances that began to occur. There were high dependency ratios. When there's an unequal distribution of wealth between quote-unquote elites and commoners. And all these factors came into play, driven by population, in both the ancient Greece and the ancient Roman empires. Humans also display population cycles, folks. And this kind of ties into that Kondratiev wave on a different level. But societies like England and France, Rome, Greece, Egypt during the Greco-Roman times, the Ottoman Empire, various dynasties in China, all the same. This is an inescapable pattern. First, there's political instability and violence. Then there is a peaceful interlude. In that peaceful interlude, the society becomes more prosperous. This decline in fertility rates, population, and the varying mixes, the shift in mixes of the population occurs. And then internally, rather than external wars, you have periods of instability and periods of internal violence. When a population is approaching its carrying capacity, is not enough to trigger general decline if, this is a really big if, the people remain united and the ruling class strong, but in touch with the people that they rule. In other words, they're ruling for the people and not for themselves. Coming right up, some amazing similarities in what this population shifting seems to do to economy and inflation and etc. You'll recognize them. One of the things that occurs as these internal population and demographic shifts occur within a civilization is that there is more folks striving or aspiring to higher positions in the society, you know, doctors and lawyers and whatever, than there are positions open to them. You know, kind of like today where you have all these college degrees out there that can't find a job. I mean, I know lots of young people. They have a college degree. They have a master's degree. Hell, some of them have a doctorate degree, and they're out working construction. This is not the first time this has happened, folks. It's happened through history. When that happens, people get disgruntled. And over time, and this has been borne out in all these examples I've been giving you over thousands of years, there is social unrest, there is violence, and particularly young adults in their 20s are particularly prone to radicalization. What do we see happening today on the streets of America and around the West? Listen, most historical periods of social unrest and civilizational decline, if they lack external triggers, you know, wars and pandemics and climate change and all that, and natural calamities, most of the genocides that you see through history, and you can go back to World War II, you can go back to World War I, you can go back prior to that, you can go back to the mass genocides which have occurred in communist and socialist countries over the last 100 years. But most of those genocides can be readily explained as a result of a built-up youth bulge. In other words, a bunch of unhappy young people who take out unknowingly their fears and their frustrations and their anger in the form of radicalization, which becomes ugly and in fact sometimes fatal to that society. Actually, all this kind of stuff rips apart the social fabric of a civilization, hastening its decline. Do you remember in previous shows we've talked about China and how they tried to manipulate population, and now how they have 200 to 300 million young men in their 20s, and there's no women for them because of their depressing. They're depressing quite intentionally the female population over the last several decades. Well, folks, how do you orient 200 to 300 million young men who really can't achieve their social aspirations and certainly can't achieve kind of the natural proclivity to bond and to mate and to marry? That's an angry and huge and powerful population. So what do you do with them? Oh, you fashion them into the sword, their army. And that is exactly what China is doing. More on that in the China segment. As all these population, fertility, demographic nuances begin to play out and begin to manifest themselves, in many civilizations, in fact in most, there arises a dominant minority, a as the archaeologists and historians call it, that forces the majority to obey without meriting that obedience. In other words, they haven't achieved the level to warrant the obedience, so they force the obedience. There was a German philosopher, by the way, does that sound familiar? Oh, yeah, that's right, the tyranny of the 3.5%, my historical story of about 6 weeks ago. Oswald Spengler was a German philosopher, and he discussed this transition in a book called The Decline of the West. It's a 1918 volume, by the way, if you want to read it. He argues that the ultimate sign of civilization is broken down, not breaking down, but broken down, is when a dominant minority forms a universal state, which, quote, stifles political creativity. First, and this is a quote from him, first the dominant minority attempts to hold by force, against all right and reason, a position of inherited privilege which it has ceased to merit, and then the proletariat repays injustice with resentment, fear with hate, and violence with violence when it executes its acts of succession. Yet the whole movement ends in positive acts of creation, and this is on the part of all actors in the tragedy of disintegration. The dominant minority creates a universal state, the internal proletariat in a universal church, and the external proletariat a bevy of barbarian war bands. Now, folks, just think about the barbarian war bands of Black Lives Matter, Antifa, etc. Think about all us bitter clingers, the religion and the guns. And think about the dominant minority, which we see running amok in Washington, D.C., the tyranny of the 3.5%. By the way, when these historians and archaeologists use the word church, what they're talking about is the collective spiritual bond of a common worship, not Lutheran or Catholic or whatever. Much bigger picture than that. Much bigger picture than that. Really, it comes down to, do you believe in God or a higher power, or do you not? That is really the glue of the word church, as all these folks use it. There was a historian by the name of Carol Quigley, and she wrote The Evolution of Civilizations. Excuse me. What he said was societal disintegration involves a metamorphosis, if you will, of social instruments, which are set up to meet actual needs, not the needs of institutions, which serve their own interests. Think about big business. Think about big tech. Think about big government, folks. At the expense of the social needs of the dominant, of the subservient minority, or the subservient majority, excuse me. And we've talked about Tony B and the Clash of Civilizations. The Clash of Civilizations, by the way, was actually a book by a political scientist by the name of Samuel P. Huntington. He thought of human history very broadly. He thought of them as he thought of history as civilizations, and he thought that the world after the end of the Cold War would become a multipolar one of competing major civilizations which were divided by, quote, fault lines, unquote. Boy, is that true or what? Continental divides, ideological divides, axis divides, Iran, China, Russia against America and Europe. I mean, this guy kind of had it nailed. By the way, this book was written in 1997, which I think is quite interesting. There's another evolutionary anthropologist, if you will, and historian. His name is Peter Churchin. He thought that there were equations that could be used to model the population of predator and prey in the animal kingdom. And he thought that they could also be used to describe what happens in human societies. Basically, he examined social factors, such as income inequality, just to take one, and how they related to political instability. And what he found in his research was that when you had cycles of unrest in historical societies, ancient Egypt, China, Russia, you name it, it's basically when the population grows, it's back to this population theory again, and the cost of labor drops. So that creates a wealthier upper class. while the life for the working class deteriorates. Does this sound familiar, folks? And then as this inequality grows, the society becomes more and more unstable. The lower class is miserable, and the upper class is entangled in infighting. Exacerbating this kind of social turbulence, if you will, eventually leads to collapse. He pegged these cycles as shorter and longer cycles, and the shorter population cycle, when all this occurred, he pegged it 50 years. And it basically consists of two generations, one peaceful and one turbulent. If you look at United States history, folks, just let's step back here and kind of look back over our shoulders. The times that this country has had serious socio-political instability is 1870, 1920, 1970, and here we are, 2020. Each one of them 50 years apart. Imagine that. By the way, he pointed out that the U.S. is not the only Western nation. In fact, all Western nations are under a similar strain. And this kind of brings us to a little sidelight, which I'm going to cover in depth next week. It's very important that you understand these economic cycles and the waves in which cycles are contained. And this is the Kondratieff wave theory. By the way, Turchin's theory was kind of released in 2010, so it was way ahead in relative terms. It was way ahead of what we saw occurring really beginning in 2016 with Trump's election, and then, I don't want to say culminating, but should we say escalating dramatically in 2020 and now. Kondratieff was a Russian economist and philosopher, who, by the way, was eventually put to death by Lenin because, you know, left-wing totalitarians really don't like free thinkers. I think we're kind of seeing that, aren't we? Kondratieff speculated, and he went back almost 250 years, that there are long cycles in economic development and contraction, expansion and contraction, and they are 50 years apart. Within those longer cycles, which are called waves, i.e. the Kondratieff wave, are shorter periods of economic boom and bust. Those are cycles. So what he did was he mapped out basically what was going to happen, what had happened in the 200 years previous, and what was likely to happen in the 150, give or take, years after 1900. He was put to death, of course, by Lenin in about, I think, around 1920. And his theory has played absolutely true to form. Just like Turchin's theory of populations and angry and then docile and then angry and then docile populations, two generations in every 50-year cycle, so too has Kondratieff's wave theory of 50 years been borne out by the economies. I mean, just look at from the time he was put to death. Basically, you had the 1920s and the Great Depression. And then 50 years later, you had the stagflation and close to economic collapse in the 70s and 80s. And here we are 50 years later facing another economic dilemma. In fact, I would call it an economic nightmare. And we're going to talk about this in depth next week. Real technical workings and examples of the play, the interplay of the Kondratieff theory of major economic waves of 50 years and what's going on today. Turchin operated kind of on a broad base level. And he didn't really pinpoint how bad things can get and how precisely a collapse can be triggered. But there was a mathematician who kind of picked up on Turchin's work right after he completed it. His name was Sada Moteshiroi. And the spelling, right? The spelling. Moteshiroi. He applied the same predator-prey model to human society, with the upper class and the lower class being two types, or two different types, of predators, and natural resources being the prey. And what he found was that extreme inequality, or extreme resource depletion, or extreme resource scarcity will facilitate a collapse. But a collapse is only irreversible if a society experiences all those at the same time, i.e. they quote-unquote fuel each other. And that's the conclusion of our civilizational historical series. I hope you found it enlightening. I did. I really did. And for any of you who missed any of the four segments, the historical segments on civilizational collapse, which are just fascinating, www.ontherightsideradio.com. They're right over there on the left-hand side of the homepage. If you get over there quickly, if a week or two goes by, they'll drop down into the archives. You can find them and just look for the word, just type the word civilization into the search bar. This should all come up if you have any troubles whatsoever. But fascinating stuff. And absolutely, as we all know, listening to this, apropos to what we see developing all around us, in America, in the Western world, with our very adverse competitors, I'm being kind, China, number one, Russia, Iran, and with the advent of different ideologies and the radicalization of, you know, our disenfranchised youth, spurred, and we're going to be talking about this, by educational indoctrination and propaganda. Next, a final thought on this series of civilizational collapse, and then we're going to be into our rat-a-tat-tat, and boy, will some of those points tie right into what you just heard on population shifting, violent youth, you name it. Okay, a couple wrap-up thoughts on the civilizational series, because it was a big historical series, might be the largest I've ever done in terms of the number of shows and segments, that in addition to all the other telltale signs that you can pick out from these historical stories and apply to what you see happening in the Western world and the United States today. Inflation is a common factor to societies which are in the process of decay, in the beginnings of disintegration. And inflation, folks, is running rampant right now. And it started really about 6 to 12 months ago, you know, with the whole COVID nonsense. And now you're into what's called the wage price spiral. Now, there's a number of economists who say, oh, poo. This modern monetary theory is just fine, and, you know, you can withstand some inflation, and it doesn't matter how much money you print. Well, that's not what history teaches us. And right now, May's consumer prices rose at their fastest rate since 2008. If you go back in time, not too far, like 50 years, oh, those 50-year waves again. Inflation was galloping ahead at double-digit rates. It drove up the prices of food, of fuel, of housing, and everything that you know and touch every day. That's exactly what's going on right now. We've talked about it a little bit on these shows. We're going to talk about it in depth sometime in the next month. Back in the 60s and 70s, 50 years ago, oh, wow, those 50-year cycles, President Johnson and then President Nixon, they were badgering the Fed to keep pumping money into the economy and pushing interest rates lower. Their theory was it would drive unemployment down, it would help their economic programs, and of course their electoral prospects. Ah, politics. The Fed mostly complied until Volcker took over in the 1980s with Reagan. But these politically motivated policy decisions, just what you see going on right now, piled up, and the result was predictably horrible. There was unrelenting inflation. The U.S. economy went into a game of leapfrog, kind of what you see going on with the labor market right now. People are trying to open up after the COVID stuff, and they can't get people to work because the government's paying them. Workers demanded pay increases back then to keep up with the rising cost of living. And most of them got raises through cost of living adjustments and then, of course, union contracts. To keep up with rising costs, businesses had to raise prices even more. So you got into this spiral, you know, this chasing the river. You know, when you riprap a bank on a river, it increases the velocity and the force of the current. So it starts eroding the next curve in the river, and you have to go riprap that bank. That's called chasing the river. Well, this is like chasing the economy or chasing prices. Economic relationships in these types of periods, and this, by the way, contributes to the disintegration of social fabric. They fall out of their old patterns. When unemployment rose, so the economists thought, inflation would fall. Except they both went up, which gave the rise to that new term, which you've heard, stagflation. Now, there are a lot of economists who say, oh, that can't happen here. That's not going to happen here again. Yeah, okay. Yeah, we'll just ignore history. But they argue that the dollar floats freely, well, yeah, right, and isn't fixed to the cost of gold because Nixon took us off the gold standard. And he took us off the gold standard because of the inflation and this spiral I'm talking about. I mean, you know, bad decisions end in bad results. And the economists now, they argue that since the dollar freely floats and it's not pegged to gold, you know, we don't have any problem of an abrupt collapse in the value of the dollar. Well, we shall see. And then they argue that rising global competition means today's workers have less bargaining power, which makes them makes it harder for them to demand wage increases in response to this inflation. And they point out that in 1976, there were 6 million unionized workers who had automatic cost of living adjustments in their contracts. But by 1995, they also argue that the number dropped to 1.2 million. And such agreements, you know, the cost of living kind of built into the contract, are now rare. So they argue that workers bear the brunt of inflation, but wage price spirals seem less threatening. Well, I agree with them in that workers are bearing the brunt of inflation. I don't agree with them in any of their other conclusions, shall we say. Since the 70s, American policymakers have been way less worried about inflation than they are about having, like, Japan's slow growth and low inflation. And they say that inflation is run below the Fed's 2% target, you know, however they came up with that, consistently since 2008, 2009, right in that time period. So they argue that what the economy needs is more stimulus, and boy, is it getting it, right? $7 trillion in the last 12 months, and Biden wants another $4 trillion bucks. Well, he wants a lot more than that, and it's not Biden, it's Obama anyway. By the way, I have a little letter, I'm presuming it's from a liberal, perhaps a progressive, talking about Obama in the mailbag. Hopefully we'll get to that today. But I want to remind you of what happened after that inflationary period. This is when Volcker took over and decided that inflation would doom the dollar and doom our economy and put the brakes on it. Do you remember back then, you folks, mortgage rates of 18%? That's right, 18%. Yeah. Along with incredibly high costs of money anywhere and everywhere. And Volcker did tame inflation. But in the end, it's really tough decisions like that that gets this long-term problem, this erosion of an economy and of a currency and of a civilization under control. Rat-a-tat-tat. Oh, man, we got a lot of stuff to cover, and we're going to try and make it quick, but some of this stuff deserves a little bit of attention. First of all, over the last several weeks, there's been this huge blow-up, and this is in Atlanta. And Atlanta, as you know, is a blue city run by Dem Marxists. There's a area of Atlanta called Buckhead City. It's affluent, it's safe, it's kind of a quiet, nice suburb. And, you know, Atlanta doesn't like that much because, you know, it's racist. So they want to put in a bunch of low-income housing into Buckhead. And Buckhead said, no, 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 we're not going to do that. And Atlanta said, well, then we're not going to fund your roads and we're not going to fund your public works. So we're going to force you to do it. And Buckhead City, congrats to them, have said, you know what? We're just going to secede from Atlanta and we're going to have our own town. And you guys can go pound sand. So good for Buckhead City. This ties right into what I was talking about 2 weeks ago. When I really do believe you're going to see the map of the United States change. I think you're going to see state lines change, And I think you're going to see lots of more minor changes, if you will, in a lot of municipalities around the country. Then our next rat-a-tat-tat, you know, Stacey Abrams, Dem Marxist liar and cheater, and election fraudster extraordinaire. I brought you this story that the temp agency that staffed like the huge bulk of the counting in Fulton County and other places in Atlanta was owned. She has an interest in that temp agency. I brought you that story, I believe, 2 weeks ago. Guess what else we've learned? The guy she put in charge of all those temps that were counting ballots in the senatorial elections and the presidential election, he's not even a United States citizen. He's a Nigerian national. So, you know, he has such a vested interest in good outcomes for the American people. Assassination of the president of Haiti. How convenient for the Clinton Foundation. You know, lots of people that have anything to do with or know anything about the Clintons wind up dead. Have you noticed that? I did a whole show on this about 2 years ago. At that time, it was 57 people. I think now it's up to about 70 folks, including now, potentially, a head of state. This was a professional hit squad. I mean, a mercenary group, well-trained, very well-armed. There was a huge firefight. A bunch of people got killed, including the president of Haiti. You know, close mouths. Dead people speak no tales. Do you know what I mean? Dead people speak no tales. And by the way, the Clinton Foundation, for those of you who don't remember, they made, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars through graft and corruption in the rebuilding of Haiti after their natural calamities down there more than a decade ago. Bill Clinton was right in the thick. Aren't they always in the thick of it? And man, are they good at siphoning those funds, particularly U.S. taxpayer funds, from where they're supposed to go. And coming right up, more rat-a-tat-tat. Oh man, make sure there's a pad on the table for when your jaw hits the tabletop. Back to rat-a-tat-tat. Oh my. Well, you know, since we were talking about Nigerians running temporary workers who in one way, shape, or form are connected to Stacey Abrams in the Georgia elections, let's talk about what's happening down in Maricopa County on the audit. It seems that they have now discovered that the voting machines down there were definitely hooked up to the internet, which is illegal. In fact, it's not even recommended, ha ha ha, yeah, with a wink, by the voting machine and software manufacturers of the voting machines. Don't you think, folks, it's time for us to go back to paper ballots? You know, Canada, they count 20 million votes or whatever it is, and it's all paper. Most of the countries around the world who don't have election problems, who can get the results out in one night, you know who won or who lost, are paper ballots. I don't think we need these machines. I don't think we need this software. I think it is a big ruse. It was a plan that was in hatch for a long, long time. Anyway, these machines were absolutely hooked up to the internet. Their vote tallies, their vote counting, could absolutely be manipulated from afar. It seems that the same is true in Georgia, Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, and perhaps other states. By the way, several of those states are now gearing up their own audits. I'll be bringing more on that to you in a show just on the 2020 election rigging, when the results out of Arizona become known and as these other audits in other states gear up. Attorney Matt DiPerno, by the way, broke this news. Quote, there was a security breach of the registration servers in Arizona on November 3rd, 2020. The corrupt Secretary of State, Katie Hobbs, we've talked about her, folks, knew all about this, as well as the Maricopa County Board of Supervisors, but they kept it hidden. So I think this is telling us at least one aspect of why the Democrats are so frantic to try and stop these audits, which, by the way, was shot down by the Supreme Court last week. Good for the Supreme Court. They said that Arizona has every right to audit those ballots however they want to audit it. And it was a huge defeat for the Democratic Marxists who want to shut down these audits and hide what really happened in 2020. It was also a big impetus to these other states gearing up their audits. Oh, the next thing we have. Coastal flooding in the United States is expected to worsen in the 2030s, according to NASA. Ha! But there's a catch to this. No, it's not climate change. It's an expected, I quote, wobble in the moon's orbit, unquote. So NASA has this agency within it. It's called the Sea Level Change Science Team, and they're based at the University of Hawaii. And they've made predictions on all this bad stuff occurring based on the moon's typical 18.6-year orbit. I didn't know this, but apparently during half of that orbit, you have high tides, which are higher than normal, and low tides, which are also higher than normal. During the other half of the orbit, the wobble causes the tides to be more extreme. So high tides are higher, low tides are lower. We're now entering that phase. And the Earth, quote, I'll quote the NASA team, quote, is currently in its amplified tide phase of the lunar cycle. But increased global warming, oh, you know, they had to get the climate change in there, and sea level rise is expected to worsen the tides during the next cycle. Quote, low-lying areas near sea level are increasingly at risk and suffering due to the increased flooding and will only get worse. Well, look, folks, I don't know about you, but apparently the words fossil fuels and, you know, methane from cow flatulence, that's nowhere in this study. It has to do with the wobble of the moon. Now, last time I checked, all of us paying $1.50, $2, $3, whatever, more at the pump, is just not going to affect the moon's wobble. Just my thoughts as a hayseed in Wyoming. Then we have a rather serious story, right? The teachers union. Yeah, the largest teachers union in the United States, the NEA. You know, this is one corrupt outfit. And Marxist-controlled. I've brought you those stories. They have now approved a plan to promote critical race theory, CRT, in all 50 states and 14,000 local school districts. Boy, doesn't that just make you feel cool about your kids? CRT is one of the most important issues of our time, folks. We may fight a successful delay action on all this stuff, but if we lose this next generation, we're going to lose the war for America, the soul of the United States, and individual liberty. We're going to lose the cohesive nature of our society. In my historical stories, I've told you what happens when that happens. So this is a really big deal. These leftists and the teachers union, they have control over Hollywood, higher education, and the news. I mean, if they're going to brainwash our kids with progressive propaganda, America will cease to be America, or it will just cease to be, which is really where China wants us. I'm going to be bringing you an entire half a show, third of a show, sometime in the next 3 or 4 weeks. I've been researching it for a while, on education and what you can do, exactly how to get a school board that you can trust to put in a curriculum that you deem safe for the country and for your kids, and to teach real stuff like math and science and reading, you know, reading, writing, and arithmetic, along with history, real history, not 1619 history or critical race theory history that teaches whites are, you know, the problem, whites are genetically deficient, whites are nothing but oppressors. And I can go on and on and on. And speaking of being woke, you know, this whole progressive, this tyranny of the minority, you know, our historical story. Disney. You know, Disney is a very woke outfit. Did you know that Disney and Coke and all the other woke folks, along with a bunch of Hollywood woke folks, had a big tete-a-tete in Idaho over this last week? Where basically they walked around, they sipped their expensive drinks, and they looked cool, and they slapped each other on the back because they're so in tune, you know. They're so in touch. Oh, yes. They have so much empathy for humankind. Disney has changed the automated announcements at all its theme parks. You know, they play before all the performances, and they used to say, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, etc., etc. Now they say, good evening, dreamers of all ages. I mean, it's also kind of a, it's a nice little you know, nod to the dreamers, to the illegal immigrants, to the illegal aliens. Don't you think Disney's just been great. They've just killed a whole bunch of stones with just a play on words, as the left does. So this change in Disney's welcome language, it's come out across the world. China, Tokyo, Anaheim, you name it. I mean, if you go to Disneyland now, folks, you can expect to be greeted by the woke folks. Yeehaw. By the way, there was a Disney spokesperson who, there was a quote in Newsweek from her. Quote, "The moves are part of the company's effort to promote diversity at its parks. As part of Disney's diversity and inclusion policy, which was first announced in April," unquote. You know, there was a reason. There was a reason I never went to Disneyland, and I have no wish to. By the way, she continues, "Inclusion is essential to our culture and leads us forward as we continue to realize our rich legacy of engaging storytelling, exceptional service, and Disney magic." By the way, that was Josh D'Amaro, the chairman of Disney Parks. So it goes all the way to the top, folks. Quote, "We want our guests to see their own backgrounds and traditions reflected in the stories, experiences, and products they encounter in their interactions with Disney. And we want our cast members and future cast members to feel a sense of belonging at work." Oh, okay. I guess grins, yucks, dealing with people and a paycheck just doesn't make it inclusive enough. So, next rat-a-tat-tat. You know, let's go back to 1787. The founders ratified the Constitution. Last week, I brought you the story of the Declaration of Independence. I read the entire text. I got almost more emails than any other show I've ever done. If you didn't hear it, please go back, www.ontherightsideradio.com, and give it a listen. It is quite a document. And there's some portions of it which are quite apropos at the current time. You know, like it is the duty of people to throw off the yoke of tyrannical government, etc., etc. So, you know, until recent times, people expressed their political views in public spaces, you know, sidewalks and streets and public parks. But since around 2010, social media has become the public park, the street corner, the sidewalk, if you will. And people have expressed their interests, their ideas, and even political views up to, oh yes, 6 months before the election. Imagine that. 1787, the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, including the First Amendment, right to free speech. And our founders laid down very clear principles to preserve liberties, prevent the government from infringing on citizens' rights, and to maintain a level playing field in the public forum. And until recent times, you know, like 2010, believe it or not, I mean very recent times, people expressed their political views, TV, radio, public spaces, sidewalks, streets, public parks. And then starting around 2010, a lot of that shifted to social media, kind of the new arena. The social media platforms are the sidewalks of the 2020s. And they kind of ran amok in their censorship beginning 6 months before the 2020 election. Gee, it must be a coincidence. Well, there's a judge. Let me step back. Florida, DeSantis passed a law which basically said that social media companies could not put a ban on the political discourse of politicians. Then an industry trade group representing big tech sued, and a federal judge, an Obama appointee, I believe, he determined that the state was going to lose when this went all the way up the ladder. However, that's not what Supreme Court precedent says. And as you know, Donald Trump has sued the big tech companies, Facebook and Twitter. The reason he was able to sue is this Florida law. So I believe there was some interplay between DeSantis and Trump. And by the way, no, I don't think Donald Trump is going to run for president in 2024. But I think Ron DeSantis will be the Republican standard bearer, and Donald Trump will be the kingmaker in the back. We shall see how accurate that determination is. Anyway, when Facebook banned Trump earlier in the year, everybody wrang their hands and, you know, the Republicans talked a good game but didn't do anything. And the Facebook said that they were protecting the public from hate speech and speech that could incite violence in the wake of the January 6th riot. Ugh, you know, I'm really tired of this January 6th nonsense. And the social media policy is, at best, folks, very subjective. And it's obviously only applied to conservatives. And it's the first time in American history that politicians were silenced for their political views. Very dangerous. Much more like China and Russia and Iran and Cuba and Venezuela than the United States. So anyway, Robert Hinkle, the federal judge, he said that the lobby groups, the legal groups which represent big tech, which are called NetChoice and the Computer Communications Industry Association, oh, how nice, would likely prevail and Florida's law was unconstitutional, and he issued an injunction against the law going into effect on July 1. By the way, the law provided for fines of $250,000 a day per violation. So if Facebook, let's say, violated the law 1,000 times in one day, well, yeah, kind of adds right up. I bet Facebook didn't like that. And next I'm going to tell you more about this judge's ruling and why it's not likely to withhold scrutiny by the Supreme Court. Very interesting. We were talking about federal Judge Hinkle and his temporary injunction against the Florida anti-censorship law. Hinkle ruled that as a private company, Florida has no, quote, legitimate government interest, unquote, in protecting free speech rights on private non-governmental platforms. To make this simple, Facebook's free to do whatever it wants with its privately owned non-government platform. Well, that's probably not going to fly at the Supreme Court. In 2017, liberal court justice Anthony Kennedy wrote in a case, which by the way was Packingham versus North Carolina, for those that are interested, that social media was one of the most important places for the exchange of views, and that internet is a public forum and serves the same purpose as a public street or park. Also held that the, quote, public forum doctrine should not be limited to physical outdoor spaces. And then in April of this year, Clarence Thomas, Supreme Court Justice, he was writing about digital platforms, and he said, digital platforms which, quote, make themselves freely and openly available to the public resemble common carriers and places of public accommodation, and that a private business's right to censorship is not universal. In fact, he said that under the common carrier doctrine that the court has upheld time after time, common carriers are required to serve everyone equally. And that's especially true when a company, a common carrier, quote, possesses substantial market power. We shall see how this turns out, but this is a really big deal, a much bigger deal than you think, for both you and the future of your country, and I might add, conservative leadership in the country. All right, next, affirmative action. You know, that kind of arose its ugly head 60 years ago, and it involves giving quote-unquote underrepresented or quote-unquote disadvantaged groups priority over others for jobs and college and government services. And, you know, the Obama third term, Biden, President Cadaver, smokescreen, they tried to pump new life into the program earlier this year. It backfired. See, there is some poetic justice in the world. The SBA had sent out letters based on their directions to a whole bunch of restaurant owners and basically said they were going to cancel all their previously approved grants under Biden's, i.e. Obama's, quote, restaurant revitalization fund, you know, part of that big COVID bill. That's on top of the 3,000 notifications it sent out on June 14th after two federal courts granted restraining orders which prevented the distribution of the funds because the distribution, the way Obama/Biden wanted to do it, was Oh, yes, unconstitutional, unequal, and racist. Aha. The SBA was ordered to prioritize the applications of restaurant owners for a 21-day period. They had to be women, they had to be veterans, they had to be minorities, or they had to be disadvantaged in some way. But when these courts came down with their ruling here over the last 2 weeks, they ruled that that prioritization was unconstitutional. And instead of canceling the program or modifying it, you'll love this, the court ordered the SBA to cancel all grants that were already approved based on that priority system. But the SBA folks can continue processing other claims. So here's a complete backfire. Obama Biden wanted to help all their buddies, you know, all those victims that they sew together into their voting constituency. And in the end, based on these court's rulings, everybody else can go ahead and keep applying for and getting their grants. But if you're a woman, unfortunately a veteran, disadvantaged, a minority, whatever, you can't even apply for a grant under Biden's restaurant relief program if you were already approved for a grant before the court's ruling. So you're stuck. You got a big old holding pattern going until some court hands down a favorable ruling for you. And unfortunately, by the time that happens, the program will be out of funds. Nice job, Barry and President Cadaver. Great. Well, rat-a-tat-tat, I brought you about the National Education Association, you know, the Teachers Union. Promoting that CRT nonsense, 14,000 public schools. Might be time for you guys to take your kids out of school. We're going to have a whole segment, I mean, maybe half a show on education and what you can do to get rid of these school boards that are allowing this woke nonsense to go on to the detriment of your family, your kids' future, and the country. But listen, we're not done. Oh, no, there's more. On June 28th, there's a website that's used by 85%, that's 85% of U.S. school teachers, which is like totally woke. It's the Woke Teachers Website Planning Guide. Critical race theory, ready-made lesson plans to indoctrinate kids with controversial dogma. TeachersPayTeachers.com. TeachersPayTeachers.com. Take a look at that site. And it's a site that lets teachers share or sell lesson plans or other teaching materials, you know, so the woke can keep the other woke awoke. And lots of them are using it. And they're using it to promote extreme political views. Extreme. Let me give you one example. So there's this two-week pre-K, we're talking kindergarten, folks, called, quote, Social Justice and Racial Equality Unit in Kindergarten, unquote. Really? And it tells the teachers to pair off kids to discuss each other's skin color. The goal being, I quote, race conscious, unquote. You know, that's just what we need nowadays, don't you think? And by the way, the same module includes another great lesson, a gender lesson. It's called Pink is for Boys. Huh, wow. So the guidance for teachers includes a plan called the, quote, Woke Classroom Plan, unquote. It talks about gender pronouns, creating safe spaces, and similar things that are designed to turn kids into being insecure and confused, which is exactly how the left wants them. You know, that makes it more malleable, makes it more susceptible to the dogma, to the propaganda. We know what the results of teaching this sort of nonsense to college kids are, right? Just turn on your boob tube to any media that has any responsibility and watch the riots and what's going on in major cities around the country. I mean, we know what that is. Remember my historical story, right? The 20-year-olds are easily radicalized when they can't get their way, when there's no positions open for them, when they can't follow their dreams, when they figure it's a dead end. Yeah, well, here we go. So now, think about what happens if the indoctrination starts at the kindergarten level. You know, that generation is not going to be well suited to carrying on the American tradition in the footsteps of the founders. And I'm putting that mildly. Our next rat-a-tat, you know, more power grab by the Democratic Marxists. So the Federal Trade Commission, the FTC, it's been focused on consumer protection basically forever. And in 2015, it reiterated that with a policy statement that basically said their enforcement principles are not going to be involved with unfair methods of competition affecting commerce. And they deemed it, by the way, in their memo, unlawful under Section 5 of the FTC Act. So basically, their own statement and the law restricted the FTC from addressing matters covered by antitrust laws. But Biden's new FTC head, Lina Khan, K-H-A-N, she announced 2 weeks ago that the FTC, a five-member commission, by the way, three Democrats, two Republicans, gee, what could go wrong, would vote on July 1 whether to rescind the 2015 policy, which would open the door, gee, big surprise, to expanding the FTC's power. You know, more federal largesse and growth. That was actually tabled on July 1, and the vote is upcoming. How Linda Khan ever got confirmed to this position by the Senate is incredible. I'll leave it at that. Look, the Democratic Marxists, led by Khan in this case, they have one view, folks. They want to expand their power to address issues such as income inequality and corporate concentration levels, you know, and diversity and intersectionality. The same stuff that the kindergartners are now being taught in the woke classroom planning sessions. Terrific. Remember our historical story. When societies become disunited, when part of the population is made angry, when the components of the formerly cohesive society are turned against one another, the results are less than fun, why don't we say? By the way, the Republicans are jumping up and down. We'll see what they get done. Mike Lee, Republican senator from Utah, he noted that, quote, the move indicated the FTC rejects the idea that limits exist to its power and regulatory reach. Yeah, Mike, they do. They reject it. Gwen Berry, the Olympian hammer thrower, you know, the gal that turned her back on the flag and, I mean, just reprehensible behavior. You know, I love the hypocrites in the Democratic Marxists and how they kind of eat their own. But the thing I really want to bring to your attention is something she said, because there's a photo from 2016 or 15, the Rio Olympics, and it was on her own website, touting her many accomplishments. And basically, it's a photo with her lovingly embracing the United States flag. Yeah. Now she turns her back on it. You know, one has to wonder what the real motivations are. But one of the things she said that really caught my attention, particularly in the context of this disintegration of civilization series I've been doing, and the fact that lack of cohesion, decreasing cohesion between the units of civilization, ultimately lead to societal collapse. Let me give you a quote, some quotes from her. Quote, I never said I didn't want to go to the Olympic Games. That's why I competed and got third and made the team. I never said that I hated the country. I never said that. All I said was I respect my people. Emphasis added by me, enough to not stand for or acknowledging something that disrespects them, in other words, her people. I love my people. Well, you know what? Her people are Americans. She seems to think that her people are black. And there's a really big difference in there, and it goes right to what we've been discussing for 4 weeks in the dismantling of the fabric of a country and of a civilization. By the way, she claimed that the reason she turned her back on the Star Spangled Banner, which is, she says, obviously her history teaching was somewhat deficit, shall we say, bereft. That she says a third paragraph of the Star Spangled Banner alludes to catching and beating slaves. Oh, my. And next, I'm going to tell you exactly why it does not and give you the proof, which apparently she was never taught. Must have been the pre-woke classroom manual that she was taught from. So let's talk about where we left off. Gwen Berry and her misguided perception of the words of the Star Spangled Banner and her lack of perception of American history. The third stanza of the Star Spangled Banner, folks, it does not speak to slaves. It does not speak to black blood. It speaks to the British commandeering American ships on the high seas and forcing American sailors to take up arms against their American brethren. That's what it refers to. Flat the facts. And in fact, the British were doing it for a long time before the Star Spangled Banner in the War of 1812, because the Declaration of Independence, which I read you last week, lists as one of its many grievances against King George the taking by British of American prisoners and forcing those American prisoners to take up arms against the colonies. You know, wow. So, there we go. Then we have Afghanistan. What a sorry chapter. I'm sure Russia is just laughing its butt off since we did basically what they did, right? Spent huge amounts of money, $2.2 trillion in the case of America. That's $2.2 trillion, folks. Doing it all wrong in Afghanistan. And not because of the troops. The troops performed valiantly, particularly in the days of Obama, which we're back in, with their outrageous micromanagement from Washington, D.C. of a battlefield, you know, microcosmic battlefield with rules of engagement designed. They could only be designed to get Americans killed. There could be no other design to them. But President Kadaver, and I'm sure in words prepared by the true President Obama, he had a major policy address this last Thursday. Quote, "We are ending America's longest war." And he announced, by the way, what don't you ever tell your enemy? When you plan to do something. Just think about it. This is just common sense, right? I mean, if you don't get along with your neighbor, you don't even tell him when you're moving cows. Never mind telling the whole world and the Taliban when you're pulling out the last American troops. I mean, we're setting this up for a Saigon experience, right? A deja vu in Saigon. Americans do not learn from history. It's really upsetting. He called the pullout, quite frankly, overdue. Oh. And so why didn't you get that done when you and Barry were running the White House the last time, President Kadaver? 90%, so that you know, folks, because the news media is not reporting any of this. Afghanistan is a wreck. It's a wreck. And unfortunately, all the poor kids who got killed and maimed over there, or scarred psychologically, their sacrifices are being left in the dust in a war that was never really pursued the way it should have been. 90% of U.S. troops have already left Afghanistan. Did you know that? And that's since Biden announced earlier this year. There's only 600, give or take, American military personnel left in Afghanistan. Most of them are guarding the U.S. embassy in Kabul or the capital city's airport. Because, you know, the one thing they did learn in Saigon is if you lose the airport, then you have a real wreck because you can't get your people out. Supposedly, by the way, the U.S. are also going to be evacuating all the Afghans that helped them, translators, etc., etc. We'll see how that goes. Obama, Biden, Hillary, that whole clan, they are not known for aiding friends and allies, or for that matter, think about Benghazi, even aiding Americans who need assistance. That's just not in their DNA. By the way, right in the middle of Biden's speech, I mean, just to give you an idea of what's happening on the ground in Afghanistan, there's been a rapid advance by the Taliban. they now control 200 of the 421 districts in Afghanistan. And there's intense battles between the Afghan government and the Taliban in another 124 of the districts. Oh, my. The Taliban have taken over, folks, since Biden got in office. All the strategic areas in Afghanistan's north. Now, to put this in perspective for you, that was the region that once formed the core territory of the anti-Taliban Northern Alliance. So, how times have changed. How times have changed. And I'm sure Barry Obama is just jumping up and down with joy. In fact, I'm quite sure of it. Now, gun control. You know, New York. New York is... They've passed legislation which supposedly will allow, I don't know whether it's New Yorkers or Americans, who knows, I'm not sure they know, to sue gun manufacturers over any harm caused by weapons. And the legislation's been signed by Governor Andrew Cuomo. I guess he had nothing else to sign. He didn't have old folks to send to their deaths in COVID nursing homes. This comes at a time, and, you know, it's all political, when New York City and New York are facing a huge uptick in crime, murder, violence, you name it. And the Democratic-led, actually the highly Democratic state legislature, they've passed all sorts of gun stuff this year, prohibiting the sale, purchase, or transfer of firearms to anyone without an outstanding warrant or serious offense, private transfers. The Federal Protection of Lawful Commerce in Arms Act, which was a 2005 act, gave gun manufacturers immunity from lawsuits related to the criminal misuse of their products. Let's face it, Joe Blow manufacturer builds a pistol. It's bought by Sally Lou. Sally Lou goes off the deep end, or the weapon is stolen from Sally Lou by some criminal, and then it's used and it creates wounding, or it creates death. I mean, it creates mayhem. Now, how is the manufacturer liable for that? Is that's kind of like suing Ford for every automobile accident a Ford vehicle is involved in. I mean, it's the same thing. Makes no sense logically, equitably, legally, or practically. But that's not going to stop a Democratic Marxist state legislature, particularly in New York. So, what the legislature says is that the New York bill will only hold gun manufacturers liable if they violate other laws concerning the sale or marketing of firearms. They don't define what other laws are. They don't define what sale or marketing is. Does that mean a local shop markets a Ruger pistol? Is the local shop liable now? Is the transportation guy who ship the pistol to the shop liable? Is the manufacturer Ruger liable? I mean, this is a big can of worms. General Letitia James, she's the Attorney General of New York, and what a piece of work. Wow. Here's what she said about the 2005 Act, which protected the gun industry. Quote, plain and simple, this was a federal overreach to protect the gun industry in every way possible. But today, New York State took an important step to right that wrong and protect its citizens from gun violence. Oh, yeah, like you really care about your citizens or gun violence which harms your citizens. Good try. All right, that, folks, wraps up our rat-a-tat-tat. We had a lot to cover. That leaves us with limited time. Once again, we don't have time to talk about rebellion versus revolution. We certainly don't have time to get into the digital dollar, the Fed coin, the Chinese digital yuan, all of which are critical. And we certainly don't have time to get into the update on COVID, the COVID vaccines, the effect on COVID vaccines, those that have been vaccinated to those who have not been vaccinated. Did you know there are 2,000, even though the press and the government has been telling us there's no shedding, there's no transmission of any type between vaccinated persons and unvaccinated persons, putting aside that this Delta variant, since everybody got vaccinated, is rather suspicious. We're going to talk about that next week. Let's look at the reality. And you know what's been uncovered? 2015 CDC and FDA papers talking about vaccine shedding and telling vaccine makers what they have to do to keep it to a minimum and to test for it. Oh, you mean they've been lying to us again? Well, of course they have. That's what they do. Instead, I'm going to throw out something for you to think about. You know, we've been kind of dancing around the edges of these segments about think outside the box, get out of your normalcy bias, what ifs, what is really happening, not what you are shown, not the propaganda, not the image, but what is the reason for things? Why are people doing things? And next week, we're going to talk about these segments we didn't talk about this week because they deserve really important and deep scrutiny so you fully understand them and you can communicate them to others and you can protect yourself, your family, and your country. But I want you to think about this. What if there is a connection between 5G, between the nanoparticles in the air? We know nanoparticles can't be detected except with special instruments. We know they break the blood-brain barrier. We know that they're being used in weather manipulation. We don't know what the ingredients are in the vaccines because they won't tell us. We do hear the stories about magnets sticking to people's arms, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And we know that energy and frequencies move nanoparticles, can create high and low pressure, hot and cold. We know that there is voice-to-skull technology that basically is mind control to susceptible minds. What if, folks, there is a connection between 5G, the vaccines, the government push, and these are governments all across the planet, to get these vaccines, and potential motive other than the obvious greed and the obvious control and the obvious use of fear as a factor of control and manipulation of a population to increase and maintain power? Is there something even deeper? We're going to delve into that next week. I think you'll find it rather fascinating. This is Reed Lance Rosenthal on the Right Side Radio. Thanks for listening. Sorry I didn't get to cover all those topics. We will get them covered. And watch your top knot. Have a great week. We'll talk to you next week.
Please remember, if you've missed any shows, just click on Show Archive and you'll find all of his shows. We look forward to seeing you here again next week for another episode of Reed Lance Rosenthal on the Right Side.